Her parents spent their summers on the Cape. After her second promotion at Abrams, she earned 3 weeks vacation, and Hermia rented a car and drove by herself to Bar Harbor, where a weekend with a lawyer turned out to be a mistake. He was recently divorced and obsessed about his Rhodes 19, its rigging and performance, and in bed, inert. When they said goodbye, she didn't bother to pretend they would meet or date again. Instead, she drove to see her family in Truro. That July, on his 55th birthday, her father threw a party, and it was a large one. Collectors and curators and critics, so her father's emphasizing the C, all had been invited, the whole catastrophe of hangers-on, and even a few of his friends. And there was a reception up in Provincetown, and then a dinner at the house and fireworks down by the beach. Her father's black cluster of curls had gone gray, and his beard was white. Lately, he had seemed subdued, favoring his left leg when walking and complaining of migraines and gout. But on that night, he had again the manic, celebratory energy she remembered from the binges in her childhood, and he sweated profusely and insisted on dancing and made the guests assemble while he tried to do the Charleston. "I used to perform the Kazatsky," he mourned. "I used to be a champ." By 11 o'clock, he was so drunk, irrevocably, irrecoverably drunk, he passed out on the living room couch. Her mother stood above him, still dismissive and seductive and aloof. "Will you look at that?" she said. "That's the great man, his very self, the birthday boy, my hero, our hero, everyone's hero, asleep." Then she stubbed out her cigarette in the ashtray by Picasso, one of the series of plates and bowls they'd bought that year in Valois, and turned to Clement Greenberg and said, "Dreadful sorry, oh my darling Clem, but may I have this dance?" "Are you all right, Dad?" Hermia asked. He didn't move. "Can you hear me?" Softly, laboringly, his chest rose and faltered and fell. "Daddy, it's your party. Piss off." She was shocked not so much by his language or that he would swear at her as by the lack of recognition in his wide-eyed stare. Glaring at Hermia, he said it again, "Piss off, piss off, piss all of you off," and built himself back to his feet and jostled his way to the porch. Outside, Roman candles exploded. Enfolded in a dancer's arms, her mother was swaying, her slim back arched, ignoring or refusing to acknowledge her husband's bad behavior. The celebration went on. Then Hermia heard, or thought she did, a truck door slam, an engine roar. "What was that?" she asked the room, but nobody replied. "Did anyone hear anything?" she asked. She saw a set of lights ignite and wheel away and veer down the driveway and disappear. "Where's Dad? He shouldn't be driving," she said. But a bodybuilder had asked her to dance, and the music was infectious, and all this had happened before. She heard, she would swear it, the crash. She sensed the collision before she could hear it, felt it reverberate up through her throat. Then Hermia closed her eyes and saw it, saw her father's truck accelerating, making for the stand of pine before the fork at Pamet Road as though itself enraged. At first she tried to tell herself that what she heard were fireworks, some partygoers out on the beach setting off Catherine wheels. Her partner asked, "What's wrong? Is something wrong?" She turned from him, turned to the door. Years later, she would remember how they learned the news. The gallery owner from Wellfleet, who stumbled back to the party saying, "Help!" saying, "Call the police!" And the crumpled, smoking wreckage, her father slumped over the wheel. She ran to where he crashed. He'd negotiated the driveway, but missed the second left turn. She would remember the steam from the engine, the shards of glass, a white pine bent double above the smashed hood as though protective, pitying, and how they couldn't open the pickup's driver's side door. He didn't die in the truck. He was a tough man, limp from drink, and had somehow remembered to fasten his seatbelt. The rescue squad arrived and, using the jaws of life, extracted him and drove him down Route 6 to the Cape Cod Hospital. It took him 3 days to die. Hermia spent the entire time in Hyannis, waiting with her mother and listening to doctors and visiting the ICU and, when permitted, sitting at the side of this object attached to machinery, this arrangement of tubing and bottles and monitors with numbers flashing on a screen and lights that went green and then red. A little in the waiting room, she slept. Once, at a nurse's urging, she went for a walk off the hospital grounds. In a nearby sandwich shop, she bought a cup of clam chowder and a lobster roll. She couldn't swallow the sandwich, however, and left it for the gulls. There were police and journalists and friends. There were many telegrams and telephone calls of support and more bouquets of flowers than the hospital could handle. In any case, the nurse explained, on account of how it wrecks the oxygen, we don't want no bunches of flowers in the ICU. Men and women with mops and laundry and meal carts were polite to Hermia, but made her feel in the way. Doctors and technicians bustled past. As always, she felt herself excluded from the melodramatic spectacle of her father's life, the privacy to which she had no access, and the large public display. She'd watched all through her childhood and her adolescence, and now she was a spectator while her father died. It was as though he ruled some distant, sea-girt kingdom, but had been deposed. His eyes were shut. He opened them. She watched him try to rise or shift position in the bed, imperceptibly, inwardly, silently. And then again he shut his staring eyes. The monitors registered this. The line of light above his head pulsated, blinked, and went flat. This is Nicholas Delbanco, and that was part of Chapter 3 of Spring and Fall.